sponsoring. I want to thank Leading Age Massachusetts for helping to facilitate these calls and helping with all the technology. Couldn't have done it without them. With that in mind, I'm going to turn it over to Lynn Monahan to talk us through a little bit of the Zoom technology, which I'm sure you're all very familiar with by now.
Hi, everybody. Good afternoon. So just a couple of functionalities of Zoom that we're going to use in today's call. So everyone coming into this meeting, the default is to be muted. So if you have a question or comment that you'd like to share throughout the call, you will need to unmute yourself. And the way that you'll go about doing that is if you are on the computer, you'll hit the little microphone icon typically found on the bottom toolbar to unmute yourself. And if you are on a telephone joining us, you'll need to press star 6. We do ask you that if you do unmute yourself, that you remute yourself after you've made your question or comment, and you would do it the same way by either clicking the microphone icon or pressing star 6. We will, for those on your computer, will be using the chat function. So we encourage you to leave your questions and comments in there. There are multiple people on this call who will be monitoring that. So we welcome you to, you know, if you think of something but don't have a chance to use your voice to share it, we ask you to put it in the chat and we'll get to it as we can. For those of you who are on the phone and might have access to email, you're welcome to send me an email with any questions or comments at lmonaghan@leadingagema.org. Thanks.
Thank you, Lynn. Hopefully you guys are all experts at Zoom by now. So again, my name's Emily Cooper. I'm with the Executive Office of Elder Affairs, and in partnerships with the State Department of Housing and Community Development, Mass Housing, and CDAC, we have come together to support efforts to help housing agencies who are really on the front line of this pandemic. We do this in a variety of ways. One is that we have developed a listserv that we ask to hear from you, and we also push information out to the community that might be of interest to you. And we have developed a single email address, seniorhousingcovid19@mass.gov. I think someone will put that in the chat room right now. If you'd like to join the listserv, you can just email seniorhousingcovid19@mass.gov. Or if you have any questions related to what's going, or want to share any information related to what you're seeing at the local level. Finally, we have these weekly calls that are on a variety of topics. We actually are going to, starting today, move to every other week. So we won't have a call next week. We'll have a call 2 weeks from now on Thursday, the 23rd, I think that's correct, at noon. And if you have any suggestions for topics or things that you'd like to hear about, please email those to seniorhousingcovid19@mass.gov. Previous calls have been on nutrition, epidemiology, the contact tracing collaborative, mental health issues, a variety of topics, philanthropy, and they're all available on the Leading Age Massachusetts website, which is also posted in the chat. Today's call is going to be a little bit different. It's going to be much more instructional than usual, and it is going to be a little bit longer. So this call actually goes to 1:30 today. We are lucky to have Amanda Kappen here from NEMA, Massachusetts Emergency Management Administration. She is a Deputy State Public Assistance Officer, and she is well-versed in what agencies can use FEMA funds for and to get reimbursement for as it relates to the pandemic. So she is going to walk through that. She is going to give information to how housing authorities can be accessing, what they can access FEMA reimbursement for and how, as well as nonprofit agencies. Unfortunately, for-profit agencies are not eligible for FEMA reimbursement at this time, although we'll try and put other resources. So Amanda, I'm going to turn it over to you, and why don't you take it from there?
Thank you, Emily, and thanks to everyone for who is responsible for putting together this call. Thank you. I appreciate it. And thanks to everyone who's joining us, whether it be from your office, from your house, or from a local coffee shop. Thanks for taking the time to join us here today to talk about public assistance. And even though the slide presentation says for housing authorities, this slideshow was specifically developed for housing authorities, but will also be very useful for private nonprofits offering housing assistance as well. So just don't be totally turned off by the title page. So we'll start this presentation. So this first slide is just a really good overview of COVID-19, the major disaster declaration. So President Trump declared Massachusetts for a major disaster deck for COVID-19 on March 27th, 2020. The incident date for COVID-19 is ongoing. We had a crystal ball and we knew when this would be over. I think you would get rich pretty quick. But the real significance here for that incident date period is that January 20. So it's important because you can claim we're gonna go over what's an eligible cost for public assistance shortly, but you can claim those costs going all the way back to January 20. So if you had disinfection costs, cleaning costs, screening costs, going all the way back to January 20, you can actually get reimbursed for those costs. As long as you are currently operating within Massachusetts, you can apply for public assistance. And if you are familiar with public assistance, maybe with past snow events that Massachusetts has had in recent years, you might be familiar with Category A, debris removal, or Category C, road repair. But the only thing that has been authorized under this declaration is Category B, emergency protective measures, as well as another program that's actually being run through Massachusetts Department of Mental Health, and that's crisis counseling. We're not going to be talking about the crisis counseling today. If you have any questions, feel free to shoot me an email. I'm sure Lynn will be sending that out or I'll make sure that she sends that out in any follow-ups to this presentation. But we're going to be primarily talking about Category B, emergency protective measures. So just what we're going to go over today, we're going to have a broad overview of the FEMA PA program. So if there's one thing I want you to go away with is emergency management folks love their acronyms. Sometimes it gets a little overwhelming, and I apologize. Public assistance, PA for short, we're going to be going over that. Eligible activities and costs, which I'm sure is what you guys want to know. So we're going to go over that, and that's been tailored to what you in the housing world have been experiencing. I don't want to bore you with what other what cities and towns have been dealing with. This is going to be tailored to housing authorities and private nonprofits that deal with housing. Next, we're going to talk about Grants Portal. What is it? How do I get into it? How do I utilize it? Then we'll go into the application process. This is where you're actually going to be claiming costs from FEMA. And then grant and project requirements. You're getting money, there's always going to be strings attached, right? Especially if it's from the federal government. So we'll go over those requirements real quickly. So public assistance, what is it? In a nutshell, it's pretty much supplemental financial assistance that local governments and certain private nonprofits receive after a declared event. So you guys are very familiar in Massachusetts, when a snowstorm hits, if it's big enough, FEMA public assistance is going to get turned on. The caveat to this is FEMA does not pay for 100% of all your eligible costs. They will only pay 75%. So what does that mean? Let's say, for example, at the end of the day, you had $100,000 in cleaning costs, cleaning your facilities, making sure that they're safe within CDC guidelines, all that good stuff. FEMA's not going to pay for all of it. They will pay for 75% of that. So they'll reimburse you $75,000 of that, but you're going to be on the hook and you're going to be responsible for that $25,000 or that quarter of that overall eligible cost. And that's policy. We want to make sure you have skin in the game. You know, if you're not going to put a little bit of your money into it, then, you know, why are you doing it in the first place? In the bold, at the bottom of the slide, I just want to mention, really importantly, FEMA will not duplicate funding with other federal funding sources. So let's say you're already, there's a federal grant out there that you get on a recurring annual basis for certain costs or certain things, certain items, transportation costs, let's say. FEMA will not provide any funding that is duplicative of that previous funding. And we can get a little bit more into that if you have any questions regarding, let's say you got funding through the CARES Act somehow, PPP loans, or other sources of funding in general. We can definitely talk through that to see if that would be a duplication. But pretty much, you don't want to double dip. Makes sense. I think most people get that concept. So moving on. So what is emergency protective measures? It sounds kind of vague. It sounds a little ominous. It kind of sounds a little law enforcement-y, right? A little intimidating. So an emergency protective measure is an activity undertaken to eliminate or lessen an immediate threat to lives and public health and safety. So broad definition, right? What does that mean? So we're going to get into the teeth of exactly what that is in a second for your eligible activities. Your eligible activities we're going to go over in a second, but the types of eligible costs that you'll be incurring for those activities is really limited to these five items. So force account labor, you know, if you have employees doing certain eligible activities, that their time is going to be eligible for reimbursement. It is limited to only their overtime though, and we can get a little bit more into that later on. Force account equipment, let's say, it's not really, I can't think of a really great example for this event, but let's say a snowstorm. You have you have elderly populations on ventilators, and you know, losing power would be detrimental to the public lives of your residents. Let's say you rent a generator and you have to run the generator for when the power goes out, that's eligible equipment costs. Leased equipment, let's say you don't own that equipment, but you have to lease it instead, those costs to lease the equipment. Eligible. Material. This is a big one for this disaster. I'm sure a lot of you have had to buy PPE, a lot of masks, face shields, hand sanitizer, cleaning, disinfection products. That is going to be eligible for reimbursement through that material cost code. And then contract services. Let's say instead of using your in-house staff to do cleaning, you got a vendor or an outside service to do that cleaning for you. Those costs are going to be eligible. So that's just very high level, the types of eligible costs. Now let's get into the actual activity. In addition to CAT B, you'll also donate resources as eligible. We'll get into that a little bit later, as well as Category Z management costs. We'll also get into that a little bit later, but just in a nutshell, management costs are, you know, you're going to be given money for these costs, but yet you're not going to be given money to manage that grant. This cost category is where you can claim costs that are related to you managing this grant. So we'll get into that a little bit later. Here's the good stuff. Okay, so what can I get reimbursed for? So the popular activities that we've identified with housing authorities so far are limited to these four activities. Supplies and commodities, including PPE, the purchase of, you know, face masks, shields, Purell. Security and screening, you probably had to hire additional people or you had to get additional equipment, thermometers, if you're screening folks who are coming into the building. Or you had to get extra security to keep people out from coming into the building. We've heard all sorts of interesting stories so far in this event. Those costs are eligible. Cleaning and sanitization of facilities. You guys have probably been working around the clock to keep everything nice and clean, especially those common areas. So that will be eligible for reimbursement. And food distribution. Food distribution is going to be a tricky one, but we'll get into that in just a couple of slides. For more information, I've included a hyperlink at the bottom of this slide that is a good overview of FEMA's eligible protective measures fact sheets. There's a lot of other things in there, like emergency medical services, ambulance services. There's a lot of different activities that are eligible for reimbursement. But again, these are the activities that we think are going to apply to you guys the most. So let's get into the first one, the buying commodities and supplies. So that's eligible for reimbursement. You guys can get, if you guys are buying PPE for your staff, you want to make sure that they're limiting transmission to your residents, especially if they're elderly residents. That's going to be eligible for reimbursement. Some things that we'll want to see, though, when you claim those costs are going to be those invoices. You know, when you had to order those PPE, invoices, purchase orders, we're going to want to see a copy of a contract that you have with the vendor to provide that PPE, if any. And then we're also going to want to see proof of payment. We want to make sure that you're paying your vendor. That's more of a policy requirement. We don't want to pay you with federal funding for you not to pay your vendor. And if you have any more questions on exactly what type of proof of payment would be satisfactory, we can definitely get into that. Security and screening. So the cost of security, very much eligible for reimbursement. Not sure. I know each one of your facilities is totally different with security protocols, and I'm sure the needs that have arisen. But let's say you had a higher security guard to, you know, make sure people didn't come in or people didn't get out to be, you know, in order with the governor's stay-at-home order during that time. Those costs will be eligible for reimbursement. Just ensure that the following documentation is included so that you don't have any problems for reimbursement. So let's say you used existing staff to do that security. We're going to want to see their timesheets. We're going to want to see their activity logs, you know, just to make sure we know what they were doing during that time. And only overtime is going to be eligible if you used employees in-house. So their straight time or their regular time most likely is not going to be eligible for reimbursement. If you used a vendor, the entire cost of that contract is going to be eligible for reimbursement if it was only for security. So for that, we're going to, similar to what we wanted to see for your PPE, we're going to want to see the invoice, the purchase order, a copy of the contract with the vendor, as well as that proof of payment. Going to the next activity, sanitization and cleaning. I know y'all have been dealing with this activity quite a bunch for all of your facilities. It's eligible for reimbursement as long as the cleaning and sanitization methods are within CDC guidelines and are not unreasonable. So we don't want you going out and getting, you know, a $1 million cleaning machine or floor waxer to, you know, clean your facility. We want to make sure those costs are reasonable and also within that CDC guidance. So documentation that we'd want to see, very similar. You'll see there's a theme here, right, when it comes to this documentation. So let's say you're using your in-house staff, you're having them clean. You know, let's say they're taking on an extra shift in order to clean, and it's a cleaning shift. We're going to want to see those timesheets because, again, only overtime is going to be eligible for reimbursement here if you're using your in-house staff, as well as those, like, some activity log. We just want to know what were they doing during this overtime and making sure that's related to COVID-19. Again, if you're using a vendor, then the whole contract price is going to be eligible for reimbursement, but we're going to want to see those invoices, POs, contracts, and that proof of payment. And then last but not least, the purchase and distribution of food. I know a lot of you, or at least some of you, have been doing distribution of food to your residents, especially if they're elderly. They can't get out, or they're somehow a vulnerable population. They just can't get out, get their own food, or the food sources that they had or, you know, have just not been there during the pandemic. The purchase of food, I've included a hyperlink to FEMA's fact sheet on this that's really useful. FEMA has found that only state and local governments are legally responsible to provide food distribution. If you're a public housing authority, you should be good because you are considered a public entity or a local government entity, so you should be fine. But for those private nonprofits out there that are not public housing authorities, you're going to have some issues trying to get reimbursed for these costs. My best piece of advice is to try and enter into an MOU, a memorandum of understanding, with a local government to provide these services on their behalf. And then you wouldn't apply for PA funding. The government would cut you a check for those services, and then they would get reimbursed on their back end. But if you have any questions on that, be more than happy to take them. And I think at this time, Emily is going to stop me here to take any questions that you guys may have right now.
You are exactly right. Good job, C. You kept yourself right on target. So I haven't seen a ton of questions come in through the chat room, except for, can we get a copy of the PowerPoint, which we will definitely send out afterwards. And somebody was looking for a link to the FEMA disaster relief page. But I see if folks want to take time now to process what you have heard and either put questions in the chat room or we will unmute some people. But Amanda, there's a question. Could an MOU be retroactive for the distribution of food?
Sorry, I had to unmute myself. So
we actually
floated that question to FEMA, asking whether or not the MOU can be retroactive. We have not gotten a response back. My piece of advice is go ahead, get that MOU in place, and lean forward on it. But we have not gotten definitive answer from FEMA regarding whether or not the MOU can be retroactive.
Okay. What if the staff I have is part-time? What's considered overtime for those folks?
So FEMA, it's actually interesting. I use the word overtime because that's the term that people are familiar with. But the way that FEMA puts it is budgeted versus unbudgeted hours. So if you have employees that are budgeted to only work 20 hours a week, and then due to COVID-19, they have to work 5 extra hours a week to do cleaning or screening, then that 5 extra hours that was unbudgeted due to COVID-19 would be eligible for reimbursement, if that helps. I think that should help.
Yes. Okay, next question. Can we cover the other 25% through the CARES Act money or other state funds made available?
Interesting question. So, I'm the first one to say that I don't know, because I don't think the federal government really knows yet the answer to that. So if you were to ask me last month, I would say no, you can't use federal funding. State funding you can use. It's really, we just care about the federal funding as match. There have been certain programs under the CARES Act, like the Coronavirus Relief Fund, which is for local governments and state governments, that they have released guidance in the past couple of weeks stating that you can use that funding as match for public assistance. So if you get coronavirus relief funding through the CARES Act, then you can use that funding as match. Now, regarding the other sources of funding that's coming down from the federal government, you would have to see what that program is allowing specifically. But for the Coronavirus Relief Fund, and again, that's being administered through U.S. Department of Treasury, you can use that funding to offset your 25% non-federal cost share. Good question. Emily, are you still
okay,
there?
I'm here. I was muted, sorry. So let me know, I got a few more questions. Let me know when you get tired. Is purchasing computers and software reimbursable?
So depends on what it's for. Right. Well, we're getting that question a lot from our independent school districts for public assistance, for distance learning, you know, what they've had to do for last school year. The answer to that is going to be no, not for public assistance. There are other funding sources for school districts to tap into to get those costs relieved off of their budgets. If it's computers and software for a local government or a housing authority, I guess we'll tailor this answer to housing authorities. If you had to buy computers and software for your employees to work from home, let's say, the answer to that is most likely no, because whatever your employees are doing has to be directly tied to the response and mitigation against COVID-19. So if you came to me and asked an ambulance service, town's EMS ambulance service has to work from home and the dispatch needs to be able to, you know, dispatch operators need to be able to call in and do their job, that would be more eligible to me for public assistance, but it just depends on where you're using those computers and those program software for. The state, I think this is a great time to also state, to say that the state does not make eligibility determinations, only FEMA does. So when you prepare your packages for reimbursement or prepare your applications for reimbursement, try to make the best case possible that this was needed. It was to respond directly and mitigate against COVID-19.
Great. Thanks, Amanda. Last one in the chat room is, if a housing authority, it looks like, manages some nonprofit agencies, do you kind of apply separately as a housing authority and a nonprofit, or can you kind of pull it into one application? What's the best course of action?
So you can do it a couple of different ways. FEMA, we've been getting a lot of that exact issue, but more for health systems that have multiple hospitals under the health system. That's been where we've been seeing that type of problem or come into context. And it really comes down to whether or not you have separate tax ID numbers. If the housing authority can only claim costs for activities that are going out of facilities that it owns or it has legal responsibility to maintain. So if you don't have, you know, for those housing authorities, if it's like a PNP that also, runs housing or manages housing, if the housing authority doesn't manage that facility, then that's going to be an issue. If it's more of the PNP is offering like food services to the housing authority, you could probably claim those costs as more of a vendor type relationship. But we can definitely, if you want to shoot me an email after this, we can get a little bit deeper into what your situation is.
And Amanda, you mentioned how much you guys like acronyms. So I'm going to say PNP is private nonprofit.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Just checking.
There are pretty much
that have come in. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Emily. I was just going to add. So PNP is anyone with a 50C ruling letter from the IRS.
Okay. Lynn, has anybody emailed a question to you?
No, I haven't received any emails.
Okay, and I think because we have the benefit of time today, can you, Lynn, remind people, I'll take a few questions if anyone wants to unmute themselves, and all I ask is that you just tell us who you are and where you're calling from, and Lynn, how do you unmute again?
So for those on the computer, you'll want to click your microphone icon, and those on the phone will want to press *6.
Okay, so is there anyone who'd like to ask a question?
Hi, this is Elizabeth Goyette from the Salem Housing Authority. Thank you for
doing
this. Hi, thanks for doing all of this. I'm doing this from my phone from home. How will we get a copy of the PowerPoint presentation, since I'm obviously not looking at it, I'm only listening?
Okay, so I can answer that one.
I'll unmute.
Okay. So we will be sending this out through a listserv that we have, and the best way to get it is to email right now, seniorhousingcovid19, all one word, @mass.gov. So it's seniorhousingcovid19@mass.gov. That will ensure that you are on the list and you get a copy of the PowerPoint. Does anybody else want to ask a question on the phone, or I'll just go back to the ones that have come in through chat?
Oops. Okay. What
did I do? Oh, I hear somebody.
Yeah, it's me, Bernadette.
Hi, Bernadette.
Hi.
Do you have a question?
Yes. What's the difference between the CARES Act and FEMA? Because I'm not sure what to put my expenses for COVID under, whether it be
and
the
Bernadette, can you tell us where you're calling from? Because that helps too.
Sure. I'm calling from the Rainham Housing Authority.
Okay. All right. So Amanda, turn that to you.
Yeah. Thanks, Bernadette. So in the state of Massachusetts, MA Admin and Finance is administering the CARES Act funding. And if you are awarded funding through the Coronavirus Relief Fund, which is one of the funding sources established under the CARES Act, you will have to apply to FEMA public assistance as well. So you have to apply to FEMA PA either way. The difference between the two is it's pretty much different buckets of money established by two different authorities. So the CARES Act was, you know, a piece of legislation adopted by Congress in response to COVID-19. So CARES Act, very specific, just COVID-19. FEMA public assistance is a, you know, it's established by the Stafford Act in the 70s, and it's pretty much disaster relief funding that local governments get after each disaster. So that's the difference between the two. But in, you know, one thing I want you guys to keep in your head is you guys should be applying for everything right now. You should be applying, you know, submit your application, submit your request for public assistance, as well as work with ANF to get that CARES Act funding. But Massachusetts has made that decision even easier for you, to where you have to apply for public assistance to even be considered for CARES Act funding.
The reason
so it sounds like apply for FEMA.
Yes.
The reason why I asked that is because some of the housing authorities automatically got funding from the CARES Act, but because of the type of housing that we are, where Section 8 new construction, we don't get any annuals, any type of funding at all. And I didn't know which one to apply for.
I would definitely apply for FEMA public assistance.
Okay. Thank you.
So for folks, there's a few more that came in through the chat room. I'm going to finish those up, and I'm going to let Amanda talk about how to apply, which is a different application process for nonprofits versus housing authorities. And then we'll have time at the end to revisit some of the questions we didn't get to. So the first thing, and this is actually not for Amanda, but as much for folks on the call, I'm going to call out Mass Housing from David Ng. There's a question that it seems like tax credit properties managed by an HRA would not qualify. Is that correct? And what I'm trying to think that through is it's not about how the, it's about the type of agency. If your management company who is managing that property, regardless of if it's a tax credit or not, is a nonprofit, then you would be able to apply for the funds. If the management company is a for-profit, then you would not. And I'm kind of saying that with a question mark at the end, but that's kind of, Amanda, it seems that it doesn't make a difference what the housing, outside of housing authorities, it doesn't make a difference what the housing is, it's what the type of agency is that incurred the cost.
Correct.
Okay.
So
Dave,
clarify that? Oh. That was my question.
Who's this talking?
Lisa Cornish from Franklin County Regional Housing Authority.
So okay.
We have two tax credit properties. They're both, you know, corporations. They're owned by a nonprofit and they're managed completely by the HRA. So we have a management
agreement. By the Housing Authority.
Right, by the Housing Authority. So do you think that would qualify?
So the Housing Authority is under, is operating in a different building that they don't own, but incurring costs under your Housing Authority arm, or you are not acting as a nonprofit at that point?
No, we have a management agreement. We bring in management income. The expenses get coded directly to their P&L. We manage all of their P&Ls and everything, you know. It's really like we're running those properties.
All right, I'm going to let Amanda chime in because this is getting more complex.
Yep. So really when we're talking, so you're eligible as an applicant, no doubt about it.
Okay.
Now, the question we're getting into is, are the facilities that you're managing eligible for you to claim, right?
Right.
So as long as if you own the facilities, yep, totally, you're good to go. If you are legally responsible for the building, so let's say you lease it and you're legally responsible for those facilities, you're good to go. But if you just manage them and you are not legally responsible for those facilities, then you cannot claim those costs.
Okay, thank you.
That was a tricky one. Okay. If we apply now for cost to date, can we apply later with future costs, or should we wait and do one application?
Great. That's actually been a very popular question that we're getting with all of our applicants. Due to the ongoing nature of this, we're just, you know, applicants aren't sure when to apply. I would say it really depends on what kind of a cost you're looking at. So we're seeing applications come through now for a lot of small projects, meaning they're under $131,000. There's a couple of different ways you can do it. You can submit multiple applications. You can submit one now for the cost that you've incurred since January 20th, 2020. We can develop those costs, or you can wait until the end of, you know, the public health emergency to submit your project application for all the costs you've incurred. You can do one or the other. If you've, you know, gotten any significant cost, I would say like costs that are over $50,000, I would say go ahead and submit a project now for the costs that you've incurred since January. You know, that way you get it under your belt. And then submit another application later on when you have, you know, when you have significant costs. That would be my suggestion, but it's up to you how you want to submit your project.
So on a related note, I think people, and you kind of alluded to this, is there a minimum amount that you need to have to apply?
Yes, you have to have at least $3,300 for a single project.
When you say project, is that like application?
Yeah, project application.
Okay, perfect. All right, last one, and then we're going to switch to the applications. If we offered hazard pay, because I know this has come up, is that additional cost considered reimbursable?
So I know this is a big one across applicants all over the place. It will depend on what your pre-disaster pay policy says. So what we've been seeing, so, you know, hopefully your entities have pay policies, right? So what we'll do is we'll look at the pay policy that was in effect at the beginning of this disaster, and we'll look through it to see if, you know, the pay policy allows for hazard pay. We've been seeing some hospitals have specific clauses for hazard pay, related specifically to pandemics, which is totally fine, then that hazard pay is going to be eligible for reimbursement. If there's nothing in your pay policy that says anything about hazard pay or additional compensation in extraordinary circumstances, then that will not be eligible for reimbursement. And I think a lot of us unfortunately fall into that bucket. So I would, you know, take a look at your pay policy, see what it says. And if it there's nothing in there regarding hazard pay, then it will not be eligible for reimbursement.
Okay, this is really the last one. Is the minimum $3,300 the total paid by the housing authority or the agency, or the 75% that you would need from FEMA reimbursement?
The total.
Great. Okay. So, Amanda, can you walk us through the application process now? And then for folks we didn't get to your questions, there will be time at the end to talk about that as well.
I would love to. So, right.
Thank you.
Just real quick before we get to that application, I just want to talk about donated resources. So we had a question, great question earlier about how can I offset my 25%. You can use it using, you may be able to use it, depending on what CARES Act funding you get, you may be able to use federal funding to offset your 25% if you get that coronavirus relief funding. But you could also offset that 25% with any donated resources that you get. So if you have volunteer labor, if you have people that donate equipment, supplies, and materials, you can actually, you know, if you keep a record of that, that will offset your 25%. So I don't want to get too much into it, but just know if you get anything donated to you, make a copy of it, make a record, and that we can actually have that offset your 25%, just kind of relieving your obligation under the grant. Next, management costs. I just want to touch on this. So we don't want to give you potentially millions of dollars of funding, right, without giving you some money to be able to successfully manage this grant. We want you to hire, you know, if necessary, you know, hire a grant manager to deal with this, because there's a lot that goes into this grant process. So FEMA actually provides you with management costs. It's only up to 5% of what's eligible, what FEMA deems eligible. So let's say at the end of the day, you know, between your security, between your cleaning, between food distribution, you incur $1 million. In eligible costs that FEMA provides you. Well, 75% of that, so $750,000, but $1 million in eligible costs. You are entitled, you know, you have to show some documentation, but you're entitled to claim up to 5% of that $1 million to manage the grant. So the uploading of documents into grants portal, FEMA meetings you might have to attend, meetings with your MEMA POCs, submitting your quarterly reports. You can get those management costs, and you can hire a vendor to do that, a contractor to do that for you, or you can, you know, have an in-house person. I'm sure most of you have like a grants writer, grants specialist on your staff that can be used to help with their salaries. So just to alleviate that burden. So that's just something to think about. Don't want to get too much into this either, but I just want to let you guys know that this is an option, that this is available to you to help you manage your PA grant. Click. And then procurement, real quick on procurement. This is a federal grant. You are expected to competitively bid all of your contracts. That being said, this is a pandemic. Emergency and exigency exemptions definitely do apply. So I just want to have this language here for you guys to refer back to, but also please note that last sentence, and it has a hyperlink to the emergency and exigency exemptions for any procurement that you guys have. Okay, next we'll get into the application part. Sorry, Emily, it took me a little bit to get there, but I got there. So you guys might be hearing a lot about Grants Portal. What is Grants Portal? How does it work? What does it do? So Grants Portal, in a nutshell, is the FEMA online platform that you will be managing your grants through. It's very user-friendly. It's live 24/7. It is recommended you use Firefox. I have learned that through trial and error. That's where you are going to be registering for public assistance. That's where you're going to be tracking all of your projects. That's where you're going to be uploading your documentation. Grants Portal will become your best friend if you apply for public assistance. I've included just a user manual at the bottom there, just to, so that you guys can start to get a little bit familiar with it. So you're all excited now. You all want to apply for public assistance. It sounds great. You think you got some costs that you can apply for. So for housing authorities, so public housing authorities, if you are a first-time applicant, meaning you've never gotten public assistance ever before in your life, your first step is you have to register your account on Grants Portal. So that's actually the first little check mark here. Must create an account in Grants Portal. Since you are a public housing authority or Indian Housing Authority, whoever's on the call, you can create an account on Grants Portal directly. You can go ahead, do it yourself. You make sure you have one or two good points of contacts on your staff that's going to be responsive, and you're good to go. Here, I've included a really great YouTube tutorial on how to create the account. It walks you through it. You should be good to go. So that's the first step. Maybe, you know, clear, it should be real quick, half an hour to an hour to do, you know, set some time later today to go ahead and start to do it. Now, for the non-public housing authorities in the audience, if you are a private nonprofit, the process is going to be a little bit more complicated for you. So prior to setting up your account, prior to getting to requesting public assistance, you're going to need to gather all this documentation, your ruling letter from the IRS, certification sheet. You can find that on our MEMA website, your mission statement, your EIN, your insurance policy. If you have other stuff like your bylaws, your charter, we just want to know what you guys do. We want to know, you know, what, why were you founded? I know a lot of private nonprofits like Family Aid. In Boston, I know they were kind of quasi-legislative. If you got anything like that, include it, give it to us. We want to see it. Now, unlike the housing authorities, you private nonprofits cannot go into Grants Portal and create their account on their own. You have to submit your registration form, which again, you can find on the MEMA website, to this email address, disaster.recovery@mass.gov. We will create the account for you. We will do the heavy work for you. We're pretty quick. I think it's about a 24 to 48 hour response time to get you a response and get y'all set up on Grants Portal, but we will get you set up. And we're gonna take, I'm sure I've got a couple of questions on that. We'll take, make sure you're entering your questions as we go along. That way we can clear them up at the end here. So this is just some information on PNP eligibility. You guys get a bit more scrutiny than governments do and public housing authorities. You know, we wanna make sure that you're doing an eligible activity. You know, if you run a zoo, you're probably not gonna be, you're probably not gonna get any money. We wanna kind of flush that out at the beginning to manage your expectations. And we just want to make sure you're that you own the facilities. If you lease facilities, it gets a bit more complicated. But we want to, see, so if you own the housing, your housing, you should be good to go, should be easy. We're going to want information on that, like the deed, like a copy of the deed or a copy of property records. But we just want to see exactly what you guys do and how you do it. There's more information. There's a hyperlink on the bottom, a fact sheet to COVID-19 for PNP. So I'll give you just real good information on what we're going to be looking at. Excuse me. Okay, all the things you wanted to know about formulation of a project worksheet. So for COVID-19, FEMA came out with the streamlined project application. So when I say project worksheet, when I say project, when I say application, they're all synonymous. Just take that with a grain of salt. And whenever anyone says any of those, it's synonymous. So just keep that in mind. As we went over earlier, a project has to be at least $3,300 in order for FEMA to develop it. You will have to be required to submit a project application. I've included a hyperlink to the PDF of the application. Do not send me the PDF application all filled out. No one's going to look at it. You will have to fill out the project application on Grants Portal. It's like a TurboTax form. Very easy. It walks you through it. But you have to do, you have to submit the project application via Grants Portal. It's going to ask you on that form a description of what you're doing, when, where, by whom. You know, have you completed all the activities already? It's going to ask you for, you know, source documentation or summaries of what you guys are doing. You know, did you contract it out? Did you use in-house labor? But it's, again, very much like a TurboTax form. It just, it walks you through it. It's a pretty, it's pretty comprehensive. Supporting documentation. I'm sure you guys have heard the horror stories about, you know, all the documentation you have to submit when you're doing a federal grant across the board. It's not bad. It's pretty easy. Just make sure that you have all your, you know, ducks in a row. With all applications you submit, you will be required to submit a MEMA workbook. It's available at that link right here. The workbook is an Excel sheet, really great tool. It's pretty much just summarizes all of your category, all of your costs that you've incurred. It makes my job and my team's job a lot easier when we're going through it. It also makes FEMA's job a lot easier because of the consistency. So you guys will, you know, just use it, look at it. It's a bit intimidating, but there's also a great tutorial on our page right under the Excel sheet template that walks you through how to use it. Really, it's, I think you guys are going to really enjoy it. Supporting documentation checklist. I don't know if I sent it to Emily, Lynn, or Allison, but I'll make sure that you guys get it. This is the checklist. We have a checklist for certain costs. We went through it a little earlier, like if you hired a vendor to do a service, we need to see the invoice, the purchase order, the contract. I'll resend it just to make sure I got it to them. But this checklist is what we have to fill out. My team has to fill out when we review a project. So I, you know, really great tool for you guys to know what we are looking at so that you guys can make our jobs easier and provide that on the front end. And then going back to the small project versus large project. So we talked about earlier how a project needs to be at least $3,300, right? So what we consider a small project is an application or a project worksheet, right? All synonymous. That comes in under $131,100. And then a large project is anything that exceeds that. The big difference here between these two is with a small project, you don't have to provide us all the source documentation. We don't need to see all of the invoices. We don't need to see all of the timesheets, but we do need to get a really good summary of those costs. Versus the large projects, again, projects that are over $131,100, we're going to need to see all of the source documentation before we before FEMA obligates it. Might get a couple of questions there. Welcome those questions. We can talk about more differences between the two and how to structure your project development to be as optimal as possible. Project reconciliation. So, we have to pretty much reconcile to the penny. So, and reconciliation occurs pretty much two times in the grant cycle. So if you have a large project, we will reconcile and make sure that 100% of that information is validated before FEMA even obligates it. So then closeout is super easy. Closeout's the second time where we do a reconciliation, make sure all the T's are crossed and all the I's are dotted. Small projects, we pretty much only do that reconciliation at the end, at closeout, and that's pretty easy. We will, once the project is reconciled and we can close out the project, we'll forward it to FEMA for closeout. just some high-level program requirements to keep in mind. So if you are awarded funding through public assistance, there's a couple of things you'll have to keep in mind. We already talked about that project for reconciliation and closeout, but another one is quarterly progress reports. You will have to fill out a quarterly progress report. You'll get sent that form every quarter just to track the progress on your large projects. So again, for your small projects, we don't need a quarterly report. We just care about your large projects. Appeals. Let's say FEMA determines that some of your costs are ineligible. You have the right to an administrative appeal. If that ever happens, you and I will be spending a lot of time together, which is great. And audits. So you are subject to federal and non-federal audits if you do get federal funding under this. You have to retain all of your documentation for a period of 7 years. Beginning from the first day after final contract payment has been made. So your last payment, that's when your 7 year clock starts. Doesn't start before then. So you're looking at, you know, maintaining those invoices, those receipts, those timesheets for a rather long time. And just real quick on the reimbursement process. So once FEMA obligates your project worksheet, your application, again, all synonymous, to the state, MEMA, so Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency, not to be confused with FEMA, will email you the project and our standard contract. And the contract is, you know, that you understand the program parameters, you understand you have to do quarterly reports, all that good stuff. Once that's filled out, you'll go ahead and get reimbursed for that cost of that project. And here are just some really good contacts and I did not include my own email address, which I don't know if that was subconsciously not included or not, but I will make sure that you guys get my email address in the follow-up to this presentation. But just to
And we can put it in the chat room too.
Oh, perfect. Perfecto. So feel free to email me anytime if you have any questions. Once you have a request for public assistance that has been approved and you're ready to get your projects in, you will be assigned someone from my team, a project coordinator, and they will be able to walk you through the process. If you have any questions, they are your personal points of contact. And then one last thing before I turn it back to Emily for any additional questions. If you have any questions, Massachusetts has developed a form stack so that you can go ahead, enter in a question if you have questions on eligibility, process questions, pretty much anything. You can go onto that link right there and ask your question. And I'm actually the one that answers those. And it's about a 24-hour turnaround time, so it's pretty quick. So feel free to enter your form stack question there, or you can email disaster.recovery with any questions that you have, again, regarding eligibility questions. You have like a really specific set of circumstances that you just want to get a little bit of guidance on, we can help you out with that. So I'll turn it back over to Emily.
Thanks. I think that was everything we didn't know we wanted to know about reimbursement. That's great. Somebody did giggle in the chat room when you said something was enjoyable. I think this is a lot of information, and if you have incurred a fair amount of costs, ways to get money. As with every fun government thing, there are lots of paperwork that goes along with it. But I really think this has been very helpful. So I only have a few questions here. It looks like for the supporting documentation, do you absolutely need a purchase order or contract? Some of our purchases were made from Amazon where we wouldn't have a contract or a purchase order, for example.
So that's fine. You can just do a printout of the receipt. Like I know I go to my order history all the time because my husband, you know, asks how much did that cost. So you can go into your order history and do a screenshot of, you know, what you ordered. Really what we want to take a look at, or what we want to know, is, you know, a description. What did you order? How much of it was, so unit items, and then how much was that cost? So if you can provide, we just need those three pieces of information. So a receipt would do just fine.
Great. Another question, if we submit multiple small applications, do we become a large project when all submissions end up exceeding the large cost factor? Would we then have to do the quarterly reporting, like if we have multiple small ones?
So there, this really good question. So you could submit multiple project applications and they would remain smalls. Another thing that you could do is you could do project versions. So let's say you submit an application for January 1st to today, July 9th, for your PPE costs. And let's say that comes out to $100,000, so still below the small project threshold, and you forget something, like, oh no, I forgot the face shields for facility A or something, and that brings you to $40,000, then you would submit a version for that project to get included. No, not even that. You would submit probably another project. To answer your question in a succinct fashion, no. You can submit multiple project applications. They won't be bundled together to create a large project. So if you only have smalls, you wouldn't have to do the quarterly reporting.
Just to be clear, Amanda, I think there's some confusion again with the word project, because in housing authority language, that often means like a building. So what you're saying is a project is your application. You are applying to for reimbursement. That application, when it gets to MEMA or FEMA, is considered a project to them. It has nothing to do with the buildings or anything. It is the word for your application package.
Yes, so project.
Okay.
Project worksheet, application, application package.
Right, those are all synonymous, okay. And is there a way to figure out if somebody's already, if an agency already has registered in the grant portal somehow?
Yep, there is. So if you want to, if you're curious, and we've been seeing a lot of this, right? Just people working from home, maybe not the best coordination or communication between staff. Someone may have already applied or registered an organization. You can shoot me an email and we can definitely check that out for you.
Great. And again, I put Amanda's email in the chat room, but it's Amanda Campen, C-A-M-P-E-N. So it's amanda.campen@mass.gov. Amanda, you know, we started off by saying, you know, for profits, this doesn't apply. Is there any place they can go to get more information about what might apply? Or they should Google something for profits organizations?
Profit. Yes. So really the agency that has the most federal funding for for-profit or small businesses is going to be the SBA, Small Business Administration. You can definitely check out their website. We can probably include a couple of links as well. I do not believe that they are doing any more small business loans. Unfortunately, I think those are capped. Those are only for agricultural businesses at the moment, but you know, the PPP loan, if you get a lender that's participating in the PPP loan, you can check into that. And you know, with the ongoing nature of this disaster, it is possible that we will get a CARES Act 2.0 or something else that does provide additional funding for everyone, including those for-profit businesses, but that is yet to be determined.
Okay. We have one more question in the chat room, and then I'll see if anyone wants to unmute their phone. Somebody's just asking some clarification around the application. if they say they do you need to do an application for overtime and then another one for PPE supplies, or can you bundle them together?
You can bundle them together. We've been seeing that's actually more common than not. We've been seeing applicants pretty much throw all costs that they're claiming in one project worksheet for a period of time. So we've seen applicants, let's say, just kind of what I described earlier, submit all their costs, overtime, force account labor, equipment costs, material costs, cleaning costs, all in one project application for since January till now. That's what we've been seeing more than not.
Okay. All right. So Lynn, have you received any questions through the email by chance?
The only question I got, if we could just for those who are on the phone, just remind everyone the email address for the listserv so that those who want the materials for today can receive those through the listserv.
Sure. It's seniorhousingcovid19@mass.gov. We will also try, I know there's a lot of material here, so we're going to send out, I think, an email with the recording, the slides, and I think you mentioned the checklist, Amanda, or any other links she has. That'll go out usually in the next day or so to everybody who registered as well, just in case you're not on the listserv, because this is very useful information, and I know some folks were just calling in via the phone. Is there anybody on the phone who wants to unmute and ask a question?
Just a reminder, star 6 to unmute.
Okay, well, I have one more in the chat room.
I have a question.
Oh, go ahead. Yep.
This is Monica Blazek from Chicopee Housing.
Hello, Monica.
Hi. So the first date that we can use for filing for our expenses. Could you just repeat that date again? What's the date, the start date for this eligibility for this program?
January 20th, 2020. 1-20-2020.
Great, because someone had indicated to us it was actually March 27th. I think they were thinking of the CARE Act. So it actually goes back to January.
So March 27th was when we were declared for a major disaster DAC. So that might be what they were thinking of, but you can if you did incur costs in February or January due to COVID-19, like cleaning costs, or you started buying PPE, you can claim that on your project.
And that's January 20th.
Yes, ma'am.
Great. Thank you.
No problem.
Any other questions on the phone?
It was wrong.
Well, no, I don't think so.
All right, Monica, you're going to have to mute yourself again, though.
Started with March 27th. First billing. This is different.
Any other questions on the phone? Okay. Amanda, can you hear me still?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I wasn't sure if they muted everybody. I have one last question, which is a little complicated, because I think it refers to the fact in Massachusetts, we have two different types of public housing. We have a program that's funded by HUD, which is federally funded, and a program that's funded by the state, which is state funded. So I guess the question is, does it make a difference if you incurred costs administering your federal housing versus your state housing? Does that play any role?
Yeah, the only, so going back to, I think, one of the first points we made in the presentation is that duplication of benefits concern, right? So if you're part of a program that's already covering those costs, I mean, usually HUD and state housing programs, they cover, you know, the baseline, that what activities you need to do your job, right? So, you know, it might include maintenance on facilities, it might include, you know, some staff money to pay staff. If you, but I don't think, I mean, they may have. So if HUD provided additional funding for, you know, your COVID-19 response, then you're probably not going to be able to claim that for FEMA public assistance. But if the, you know, HUD or state program funding does not cover those COVID-19 costs, then you should be in the clear and you can apply for FEMA PA.
So the question that came in and actually was the opposite. Somebody said, can the FEMA funds be used for the state program or just the federal? I think what you're saying is it can be used for either of the public housing programs as long as it wasn't paid for by somebody else already. As HUD hasn't given you money already.
That was a great summary of what took me way too long.
No, you said it very clearly.
That was
okay.
That was perfect.
So let me just give another few seconds because we have the call until 1:30. I think Amanda has finished everything she wanted to say, and I've made it through, I think, every question on here. But I want to make sure there's not some question. Again, we will email out the recording and the PowerPoint and the workbook and the after this. It might take a day or so. That has the PowerPoint has all the links and the emails that Amanda talked about. And I think that's it for the larger group. Whoever likes to participate in these calls, our next call won't be until July 23rd at noon. And we are working on topics, so if you have any suggestions, we're open to that. Any last questions for Amanda before she moves on to her next project? All right, well, what I want to say is that we are getting, actually, I'm not getting any questions in the chat room, but Amanda, I'm getting a lot of thank yous. This was great information. Be well, excellent job. Thanks, Amanda. So I just want to reiterate that as well. Thank you for taking the time. This was really helpful. I think there was a lot of confusion out there, and having you as a resource was really great and useful to people, especially right now. So thank you for all you're doing, and thank you for your help. And everybody, oh, wait, last question. What's the turnaround time for approval and payment? I think this is an important one.
Yeah, so depends on what size your project is. So a small project that's well put together. You know, if you give us a project that's if you give us an application that is a mess, not reconciled, difficult to follow, that it's going to take longer. But for small projects that are well put together, from the time of submission for the project application to obligation, it's been about a month for a small. And a large project, it takes a little bit longer than that. I would say probably about 2.5 months for a large project from
okay,
the time of
great.
Submission.
Okay. All right. Well, be safe, Amanda, and everybody on the call, and thank you for joining. And we know who to talk to if we have any questions about this in the future. So thanks, and thanks to Leading Age and everybody on the call. And take care. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
Bye.